So I went to Marcel and I said, you don't want me to write this book, right? You don't want me to say like personal things. And he said, no, I do. And he said, I want people to know about me.
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring and where we talk about writing and life. I am your host, Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
I am constantly looking things up to try and make up for what I feel was a, quote, primal deficit in my education about the world. Recently, in order to try and capture the various nuances of what I describe as this primal deficit, I started working on a list of synonyms for the word naive. My list included naive, that was the first one, clueless, unknowing, gullible, ignorant, innocent, guileless, blind, dumb. Then I looked up other synonyms for each of these words and found other nuances, like for naive, inexperienced, unexperienced, immature, adolescent, green, raw, youthful, trusting, simple, innocent. And there's kind of a funny story that lives underneath both of these self-observations that I have, both this primal deficit and my proclivity to look things up to make up for it. It's about my grandma Ruth. As I've mentioned in my recent episode with Peggy Cook, I grew up in a religion where keeping our thoughts pure from any hint of disease or discord was a daily goal. The small town I lived in was overwhelmingly Catholic, though, so as the only kid who was different in this way, I was also pretty isolated in this rigor of the mind, where I got pulled out of science class from time to time when we would discuss things like disease. Grandma Ruth was a deeply spiritual woman and the source for this religion in our family. She loved studying the Bible and science and health, and also loved a good game of Scrabble. I remember her always saying, "You should never be more than an arm's length away from the Bible." Even as a kid, I found this to be an uncomfortable recommendation, but after a long coming out from this religious training in my adulthood, I changed my opinion just a bit. The recommendation had been a good one. It was just the book that was wrong. I changed it to a dictionary, and there I was, a step closer to myself. Grandma Ruth's passions also were partially planted in me. To this day, our Saturday night Scrabble game has become a ritual that has been elevated to the level of sacred. That's just my own little anecdote for you. Back to our conversation at hand. Today, I am talking with Jen Dupree, who is the author of two novels, The Miraculous Flight of Owen Leach and What Do You Want From Me?, as well as the book we're talking about today called Slow Motion, A Memoir of Friendship, Disability, and Advocacy. It's about her friend Marcel, who has cerebral palsy. I read the whole book before I realized I think I kind of know what cerebral palsy is, but do I? Naivete? Clueless? There's that primal deficit at play? So here's part of the overview I found when I went to the Mayo Clinic website. Cerebral palsy is a group of conditions that affect movement and posture. It's caused by damage that occurs to the developing brain, most often before birth. Symptoms appear during infancy or preschool years and vary from very mild to serious. Children with cerebral palsy may have exaggerated reflexes, the arms, legs, and trunk may appear floppy, or they may have stiff muscles known as spasticity. Symptoms can include irregular posture, movements that can't be controlled, a walk that's not steady, or some combination of these. The cause of cerebral palsy and its effect on function vary from person to person. Some people with cerebral palsy can walk while others need assistance. Some people have intellectual disabilities, but others do not. There is no cure, but treatments can help improve function. The symptoms of cerebral palsy may vary during the child's development, but the condition doesn't get worse. The condition generally stays the same over time. So even within this description, you can hear how there's a lot of room for differing degrees of types and severity. But the bottom line is, we are all our own set of circumstances. Jen's is a story about her friend Marcel, which kind of breaks one of the very first rules of memoir, the idea of telling someone else's story. But she will talk about how that happened and the sticky inevitability that if you're going to tell a story about friendship, there's not only the side about your friend, there's also you. So here we go. I will say, for the sake of our listeners, that this is actually the second time, Jen Dupree, you and I are having a conversation about your book, Slow Motion. So some people may be listening a second time who were at the Literary Salon in Brunswick, where we had a conversation in person about the book. So that was a really special thing because we got to meet. And so with that, I will also say welcome to Daring to Tell. It is really great to have you here as well.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for having me. Wednesday night was so much fun. So I'm looking forward to this.
Yay. I'm excited too, because I feel like, okay, now I get to ask even more questions. Where I would like to start actually is rewind way back. I would like to know, what's the beginning of your writing story? How did you start writing?
That's a great question. I feel like I've been writing all my life. I've certainly been making up stories all my life. I remember writing as a really little kid, I would make up stories.
Like out loud or writing, well, writing?
Writing, writing. And my first memory is my mother's friend gave me the whole set of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Chronicles of Narnia, the whole set.
Yeah.
So I remember taking The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and on like lined paper, rewriting a story like about a swan instead of a lion. And I plagiarized more or less. But I actually,
you're inspired.
I think that's actually a good writing tool for writers if you're trying to learn how to do something. It was actually smart, you know, and I must have been only like 8 or 9, mm-hmm. but I really like that story in particular. I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to write things like this.
I love that. And when you said that, you reminded me, I did a not dissimilar thing. I loved Judy Blume. And so I read all these Judy Blume books. And I remember I would write stories, all fiction. The girl who would be me if everything was exactly the way I wanted my life to be. But also another thing I did, I guess it's part of the like envisioning ourselves in our stories somehow, maybe. I would take Judy Blume books and I would like set them as if they were a movie. I'd be like, okay, this is happening in this house that I have been in when I was a kid that was a really big house. And I'm imagining what that looks like. And I would cast them all. Like, I loved that starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, which is kind of funny because that's her imagining herself in a movie. And so I was imagining myself as Sally J. Friedman. But yeah. I think the point of play is really a good one because it's a natural inclination when we're kids to want to do something creative, and writing is a fun thing. It's like creating our own world.
Yeah.
So how did that blossom or grow from that point?
Well, my parents were pretty opposed to the idea of me majoring in English, becoming a writer. They thought that is no way to make money.
Right.
And so they pushed hard. And I got a degree in healthcare. And I only took one college writing class with the most wonderful professor, and she was really encouraging. I actually wrote a lot of nonfiction in her class, which I don't tend to write.
Yeah.
But she told me I write like Annie Dillard, and I have never let go of that.
Wow.
I know. I don't think it's true, but I don't even care.
Yeah, I know. Let them see what they see in it. Right.
It was just such a lovely compliment. And she and I kept in touch for years. Like, we wrote back and forth. She really wanted me to study English, and I didn't. So I left college, and then I started taking writing workshops with various authors, and I really liked it. And I started to get like a little bit of success, you know, having a story published here or there.
Yeah.
And then I decided to get my MFA, which really, really felt like, oh, here are my people.
Yeah. And when did that happen? Was that young or older in your life?
I graduated in 2015. So it was just before I turned 40.
Oh, okay. So you had had a bit of life experience.
Yeah.
Which is a good way to go back to something. So you had a degree in healthcare. Is that like, how did you find yourself working in a nursing home? That's my next. Because like, to set up this book, which I haven't, did I say the name of it yet? Slow Motion. Okay, good. You meet Marcel when he is in a nursing home and you are working as the
activity director.
In my mind, activity. I was thinking cruise director, but it's not a cruise.
Similar,
right.
No alcohol.
No. Oh, God. Forget it. No. Sorry. So how did you find your way to that job? Because I'm just curious about that genesis of you meeting him.
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to work in nursing homes. My grandmother had been in a nursing home from the time I was 10 until I was 18 when she passed away. And so I spent a lot of time in nursing homes, and I liked it. I mean, as much, I liked helping people.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah.
So I did my college internship at a nursing home in activities. And then I got a call from the director of their sister facility. They were demoting the activity director who had been there for 40 years.
My God.
Yeah. I told this story recently, and I was like, only a 21-year-old would take that job. It was a terrible idea. I mean, everybody knows that's a terrible idea.
I don't know why
at 21 I thought this is an opportunity.
Because you were 21.
Because I was 21.
Yeah.
I was only there, I don't know, a few months when Marcel, who had been living on his own, but had, as you'll see in the book, like various problems with that. It was not successful for him to live on his own. So he decided he would go to a nursing home. There were no other options at the time for people with significant physical disabilities.
Right.
And so he moved into the nursing home, and we met right away, because that was my job, to meet people when they came in.
Right.
So, and I just liked him right away. And he was 46 at the time.
Right.
And which is the age I started writing this book.
Wow.
So but 46.
And you probably thought he was old when you were 21.
Well, not as old as everybody else.
Right. So he's this weird in between age where he's still old, but he's not as old as everyone else.
Right.
So he's sort of your closest compatriot in a way.
And it was so hard for him. I could see how hard it was for him. He had no one to talk to. I mean, everybody in a nursing home has dementia or has various things. That there was one other woman who had cerebral palsy. She passed away maybe 6 months to a year after he got there. And he was lonely, and he was fun to talk to. And especially when you're, again, I loved helping people, but you don't have lots of real deep conversations with people in nursing homes often. So it was fun talking to him.
Maybe can you give us a little bit about this book or him and the nature of that proximity? Because I think a lot of us can relate to finding ourselves in a position where you get to be friends with someone because there's this time and proximity to a person in a place. Because you guys hit it off right away, which is nice. But what I'm curious to know is to describe the significance of his disability for someone who might not know, or even I don't have a full picture, I would say. I mean, I've read the whole book and I have an idea, but can you describe cerebral palsy and the nature of that disability?
Sure. Cerebral palsy manifests differently in different people. And often just kids that are born with it now receive a lot of physical and occupational and speech therapy right away, which Marcel didn't have. He was born in 1950. So he's a quadriplegic. He's in a wheelchair that he operates. It's an electric wheelchair. He has like a little joystick on the side that he uses to motor around. And he can't talk with his voice. He has a communication device that he operates with it's actually a sticker that acts as a laser so that he can land on different squares, and the communication device will recognize what he's trying to say and speak it out for him.
Right.
So it's significant.
Did he have that communication device when you first met him?
Yeah, although it was, the technology is so different.
Yeah, well, that's what I wonder.
He has always had it. And in fact, his software is starting to get a little weird. And when I called Tech Help, they said, it's because he's had it so long and added to it so long. And I mean, he's one of the first people to get this. And I have to say, I've tried to figure out where things live on his communication device. He has to remember all of that. He has to remember.
Yeah.
You know, it's usually two or three keys to get to a word. And he has to remember where all those are. There's not a chance I could do that.
And I was going to say, so if you've been in the position then of helping him, and can he explain to you with the device about how to use or fix the device?
Sometimes, but there's also a really good tech support that they are amazing, and they will very patiently walk you through it, but they can also remote into his device, which is nice.
So. Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is another really interesting facet of your friendship to me. It's communication is one of the things I was thinking about, because there's a lot in the book where you talk about communicating with him, largely through his communication device. In one of the early chapters, I believe, you're talking with a woman who was like in charge of his device, and he had had some problem with it, and you had to go to tech support. But as I understood it at that point, whenever that was, there was only like one person in Maine who was the person who could do that. Am I remembering this?
So his friend Becky, who was his speech language pathologist, there are very few speech language pathologists who study augmentative communication devices. It's just, I think it's becoming more popular now.
More common, yeah.
But it was super uncommon, you know, at the time. There's always been like a tech support for the company that makes the device that you can call and they'll walk you through it.
Right.
In person, Becky would help him with his device, and she was so knowledgeable, you know.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm like, I don't want to get too bogged down in tech support, but can you also talk about the nature of getting to know Marcel and learning the communication with him through the device, but he uses his voice too. So I guess, who is Marcel without words?
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, he has been without words because his communication device sometimes breaks and it's not waterproof, and occasionally he's gotten stuck in a rainstorm, and so I mean things have happened to it, and so it is really hard for him to try to use his voice. I mean, speaking is all about the breath over your vocal cords and having control over that, and he just doesn't have that.
Right.
So I always think, you know, he didn't have anything in the early years of his life. He didn't have a communication device until he was, I want to say, 30. So I think that's what makes him such an incredible observer of life. You know, he does not miss anything. He knows everything about everyone. I say in the book how he used to give me directions when I would drive the van, because he knows his way around Lewiston, like, which is where he grew up. which is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, as somebody who's never driven, I mean, I don't know directions and I drive.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there's like, we've mapped ourselves in places of our childhood. So yes, it makes sense. And I guess this is another unspoken thing that we're discussing about him, is that the disability is significant as a physical disability, but he does not have any cognitive disability. He knows what's going on. He is in charge of himself, and he makes his own decisions. I wonder if you want to extrapolate on that at all.
No, and I think it's important to say that, because I think sometimes, almost all the time, people associate a physical disability with a cognitive disability.
Exactly.
And if you take the time to get to know him, he was in one of the group homes, and it was a terrible experience, his first group home. And the woman who was in charge of that group home, the house manager, I said something in a meeting like, why do you talk to him like that? You know, and she said something like, oh, you know, you have to understand, we're used to talking to people who have developmental disabilities and they don't know any better. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, but I feel like you should approach every person as if they don't have a cognitive disability and go from there,
right?
Like, adjust accordingly. Like, that's what I learned in the nursing home with people with dementia, because even if they have pretty significant dementia, doesn't mean, well, nobody deserves to be spoken to like a child. I don't even think children necessarily deserve to be spoken to like a child.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there's no reason to infantilize somebody who's old or somebody who's disabled. I feel like we should go with the idea that people will understand. And then if you have to modify a little for them to understand because they didn't get what you said, fine. We should be leading with the idea that people don't.
Yeah. A lot of what your book is about is demonstrating this difference of how people observe someone, but who they are inside, and how we know, as our fully actualized selves, we know that there's a difference, but it can be hard in difficult situations or other situations to not assume that someone can't understand or is not responsible for themselves. And in the situation of a really close friendship, that's a lot about what unfolds with you and Marcel and your friendship. And that's a beautiful and eye-opening and really positive example to see in the world. Do you want to describe how the book came into being?
Sure. So my friend Melanie, who's been on this podcast, is a memoirist, had long encouraged me to write about Marcel. And I had said, absolutely not. I am not doing nonfiction. I'm not a nonfiction writer. I make stuff up. So she had long been saying that. And then as life happens, I started having panic attacks and I entered therapy. And over like many sessions, you know, you talk to your therapist about everything. And I would talk a lot about Marcel. And my therapist said, it was interesting because this harkens back to what you were saying before about when did you start writing? He said, you see the whole world in stories. Like I said to him, doesn't everybody?
Wow.
Apparently not. So he said, you know, I think it'd be really good for you to start writing about Marcel. And I said, did Melanie call? So I feel like sometimes the universe tells you, like, you need another nudge. And I joke, but it's not really a joke, that I like to be good at things and I wanted to be good at therapy. So I you know, I wanted like an A+ from my therapist.
Yes, of course.
So
me too.
Like, I need to be good at, I want to be a good student. So, I went to Marcel and I said, you don't want me to write this book, right? This is a terrible idea, right? You wouldn't want me to write about you. At the time it wasn't even a book, but I said, you wouldn't want me to write about you. And he got really excited and nodded. And I said, no, I don't think you understand. Like, you don't want me to say like personal things. And he said, no, I do. And he said, I want people to know about me. And, you know, and I've never been good at saying no to Marcel. So I started it just as essays. And I wrote them all in the second person as if I was writing them to him, because I you know, writers have to trick themselves into various ways of doing things.
So that was that's part of the book, is it's in second person. So you actually started with that.
Yeah. I mean, it was the only way I could do it. It was the only way I could really do it. And when it came to the editing process, my editor said, I mean, some of these sections they're not things you would tell him. He already knows them. So it wouldn't make sense for it to be in second person.
Yeah.
Which I resisted because I didn't want it to be about me. I wanted it to be about him. But I think it still is. It's about both of us.
It is about both of you. And it's a book about friendships. And I don't think there's a lot of books about friendships. I could be wrong. Maybe we'll hear all kinds of people, books about friendships. But it's a book about a special friendship and how, and a just a regular friendship. Like I say, a special friendship is very, makes it a little too precious even. Like, we're just friends. And the part that you read on Wednesday, which we're not going to read today, had a lot of just the things that you like about each other and what he sees in you and what you see in him. And those are the things that when we are asked, like, why, maybe often with our partners more so than our close friends, like, what do you love about this person? It's like, I don't know. Gosh, I just love him, you know? He's really, you know, like, I don't agree with him. Although you agree about some things, you disagree about other things, you have different kinds of music you like. But, you know, I especially loved that he looks out for you. He opens a door for you when there's an automated door. You are a person who does not eat gluten.
Right.
Present company too, which was kind of fun to discover. Anyways, when you ordered a taco bowl and it came in a gluten taco shell, he said, go return it. You know, you can't have that. He's looking out for you. And, and I think, I mean, I can see how the setting in this nursing home, he's not having any kinship of camaraderie there, and he's really fun, and you guys just get to be friends, and it grows from there. So this book is written in present tense, but it jumps all over the place. So when you asked him about writing about him, and do you think you wouldn't want me to write about you, would you? I mean, you had to be pretty close by that point, I would guess.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, this was I only started, you know,
barely reading.
5 or 6 years ago. I mean, that's which is
okay,
fast
yeah.
for me. I'm not fast. I'm not a fast writer.
Okay. I was wondering, like that would be super fast for me. And I think in a memoir genre world, that is kind of fast, because I think a lot of times people are thinking about these personal issues or experiences for a while. Before we hear what you're going to read for us today, I have another deeper inquiry into Marcel's voice. And that is about his communication voice. Did he have any say in what that communication voice sounds like? And how do you interact with him as that generated voice, maybe, should we call it?
Yes, he does have some say in it. There's actually, within the device, you can change the voice. And Steve and I, my husband, we thought it'd be really funny. We changed it to like a woman's voice once, which we thought was hilarious.
What did he think about that?
He did not like that.
No. But,
I mean, so yes, and there's like children's voices.
Wow,
so
yeah.
It's so familiar to me now. It's hard to think of how I felt in the beginning. But sometimes every once in a while I'll hear his voice because it's a voice.
So if someone else has picked that voice, you're like, oh wait, that's Marcel.
I guess I don't hear it any differently than I hear any voice now. But it's 30 years he's had this voice. And
so, and it's been consistent over that time.
Except when we're playing practical jokes on
it. That's very interesting, because I was thinking about the voice in terms of generated voices and how a voice is such an intimate and personal thing, and how I assumed that you have bonded with his generated voice.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
I think that's really true. Like, it's such a part of him.
Yeah.
Just the way you feel about hearing any, you know, your friend's voice, your husband's voice.
Exactly. Okay. Well, with that, would you like to read the chapter that we've picked for you to read today?
I would love to.
All right. So whenever you are ready, go ahead with the chapter.
These things happen. Basic disability etiquette involves treating people with disabilities with respect. For example, speak to the person directly, not to the person accompanying them. Do not make assumptions about what they can or cannot do. The impact of a specific disability can vary widely from person to person, so offer assistance only if it appears to be needed. Acknowledge and respect the individual's ability to make decisions and judgment on their own behalf. And that comes from the National Disability Navigator Resource Collaborative. Marcel asks to take a walk through the sleepy neighborhood behind the nursing home. It's a decade into our friendship, and we're comfortable with each other, easy in our conversation as well as silences. I walk, he rolls. I talk, he listens. The sun is warm, but not so hot that either of us is sweating. Not so hot that I worry he'll get woozy. Like the time he denied he was hot until I insisted we go into the over-chilled nursing home, where he threw up and the nurse looked at me like I was irresponsible, and I reminded her that he can make his own decisions, even when they're bad ones. I reminded her we're just friends, as if there's anything diminutive about friendship. What I mean is I'm not his caregiver, his power of attorney, or his mother. He is his own person. We're just two people who get along. And I treat him like I'd treat any other friend. I ask if he's okay in the heat, and he asks me back, and I say yes, and when he nods in return, I believe him. We're an unlikely pair on the surface, Marcel in his 50s, me in my 30s. Marcel with cerebral palsy, talking with a communication device, navigating the streets in an electric wheelchair, operated slowly with the use of one semi-able hand. Me, never having had so much as a broken bone, talking almost constantly and gesturing wildly while I explain and interpret and consider out loud. Still, we have a lot in common. Both raised Catholic by mothers who worried a lot. Both lovers of food. Both lovers of sun and heat. Music, although he likes classic country and I'm an 80s rock girl. Puns, people watching, dogs, and walks and rolls outside. On this day, it's bright, and I'm not worried about anything. It's a nice day, and there's no one else out. A few distant cars, a few times I've nudged him away from the middle of the road or the soft, sucking shoulder at the edge. I'm talking, and so at first I don't see that the young, loping man who has come out of his house is heading toward us. From the corner of my eye, I notice him saunter down the pavers, through the overgrown shrubs, but I think he's going to his car or the mailbox. His house is white, without shutters. There's a dog barking somewhere, but not one I'm worried about. We both like dogs, but sometimes they don't know what to make of Marcel's chair, and they bark or growl at him. Usually the dog is with an owner, and the owner yanks the dog away, looking astonished and abashed, as if the dog is responding to his disability and not simply the oddity of his chair. As if the dog is expressing its owner's discomfort. It's the chair, I usually say, to make them feel better. Sometimes, though, the dog is alone, with no one to pull him back, and I fear having to kick it away so it doesn't bite Marcel. We've just started our walk in this quiet neighborhood of mostly single-family homes, no McMansions, a few broken-down cars, a handful of garage doors that are always open, and which we suspect are broken or left open for the cats. We each have our favorite houses, the long, low green one, the yellow one with the tremendous garden, the brown one with the Christmas wreath on the door, even though it's July, the two-family with the nice lady who knew Marcel from somewhere and often comes out to say hello. But we aren't there yet. We also haven't reached the house where, a few weeks ago, The car backed out of the driveway and hit Marcel. Tapped him, really, at least in the terminology the police would use when he had the nursing home staff call them, diminishing the incident even as they wrote it down. I couldn't imagine they'd call it a tap if he were a kid on a bike instead of a man in a wheelchair, but I wasn't with him when he took the police back to the house, so I couldn't add the proper gravity. The house of the man who hit Marcel with his car is white with black shutters with additions on each side. It's just around the corner, but that's no excuse. The old man in that house was sorry, so sorry. He didn't see him, he said. He didn't admit that he didn't look in his rear view, didn't look over his shoulder. He said Marcel wasn't there, and then he was there, which is impossible. Marcel cannot dart out. Darting is not something he has ever done. He hit him with his car, but he didn't run him over. To his credit, he stopped, got out, asked if he were okay. He interpreted Marcel's reaction as him being okay, even though he was shaken. He said, "Okay, I'll leave you to it." And then he got in his car and drove away and did not make sure Marcel was steady enough to get himself back to the nursing home. I wasn't there the day Marcel got hit by the car, but he showed me the house. I said, "At least he stopped." He shook his head. "He didn't stop?" He shook his head again, frustrated this time. I felt the tingle of anxiety I get when I sometimes misunderstand Marcel. "He stopped," I say, guessing, desperate to get it right. "But he didn't wait with you or help you get home or call for help." Marcel makes a noise between outrage and acquisition, a yeah with a pitch of anger. I can tell by the way he nods that I've successfully or nearly successfully articulated what he wants to say. His communication device doesn't work in the sun, so today this is the best we can do. It makes me feel useful to give Marcel my time, my attention. I also feel the particular pleasure of this friendship, that he has chosen me to be the one to help him tell the story of what happened. I don't feel this way in any other area of my life at this time, in my early 30s. All my other friendships are casual. Steve and I are dating, but not living in the same state. My parents are healthy, and I'm working as a receptionist for a chiropractor, which means I answer the phones 20 times a shift and thank people for calling, but don't do what I consider meaningful work. The man told the police he was sorry. They told him to be more careful, that it could have been a child he hit. We can see the house of the man who hit Marcel from where this other man is coming down the path, not to his car or mailbox, but to us, apparently. He is taller than I am, but not tall. He has a gray and brown beard, longish gray hair, dirty jeans, a t-shirt. He says to Marcel, "Let me heal you." There's not really time for us to do anything. I could yell for help. I could shout at him to go away. Marcel could give me a wide-eyed plea, and probably then I'd do something. Probably then I'd tell him we aren't interested in his brand of healing. I'd likely be polite and a little wimpy. Later, I'll tell myself and Marcel that I didn't want to provoke someone who might be mentally unstable. He'll agree I made the right decision, but that's because he's a good friend and doesn't want to hurt my feelings. Marcel doesn't move very quickly in the best of circumstances, and in times like these, when he's stressed, his muscles refuse to fire at all. I could switch his chair to manual and skitter him away, but I don't because I don't think of it. I have only ever put his chair in manual in emergencies, once when the fire alarm went off at a hockey game and he was so stiff with fear he couldn't move at all, and once when I got him stuck in the sand at the beach because we both thought he had enough traction and clearance to get a little closer to the ocean, and we were both wrong. On this deserted street, I stand beside Marcel like I've become a stop sign, only I haven't, because the man with healing intentions doesn't stop. The man puts his hands on Marcel's head and mutters something, a prayer, an incantation, a spell. And then he touches Marcel's shoulders, then Marcel's head again. Marcel stays very still, except for his eyes, which slide toward me. I meet his gaze. He doesn't make the noise he makes when he's angry or upset. He doesn't make any noise at all. He doesn't seem afraid as much as inconvenienced, and so I relax a little. This is weird, but not dangerous weird. I worry the man might kiss Marcel because suddenly he puts his face close to his, but he doesn't. I'm so relieved he doesn't kiss Marcel that my legs and brain go soft. There, he says. Thank you, I say, and then, furious with myself, I add no, but he's gone by then. What on earth am I thanking this guy for? For pretend healing? For invading Marcel's space? For not trying to mug or kill us? Or am I just thankful he didn't touch me? I think I'm just astonished, plummeted into a kind of polite stupor, like the muscle rigidity that comes on with Marcel's fear. We stand and sit in the street under the hot sun. We wait for him to get all the way inside and close the door before we exhale. We look at each other, and I notice Marcel's posture is the same. Hand on the joystick that controls his chair, slight lean forward with a slump to the side. He doesn't seem upset. I make a joke about how he should be all better now, how he should be able to ditch the wheelchair, get up, and walk home. I feel like crying, but we laugh. The wannabe healer could have done something much worse than put his hands on Marcel's head and muttered a few words. He could have had a knife or a gun, or he could have used his hands to punch him or steal his money. What could I have done to save him? To save us both? Maybe nothing. But also, it's not okay to just touch other people. We all know that, right? Still, I won't give in to the idea that it's safer if Marcel stays inside the confines of the nursing home, which has been mentioned to both of us separately by nursing home staff. They say they can't protect him if they can't see him. They say no one else in the nursing home gets to go outside without supervision. I remind them he does not have Alzheimer's or any other dementia, that he will not get lost, that he understands the risk he's taking. His wheelchair battery could die and leave him stranded for hours. This has happened, which prompted the nursing home to tape a sign to the back of the chair with his name, address, and the facility's phone number. He could get caught in a sudden rainstorm. This has happened, and shorted out his communication device, which meant months of him having no way to talk while it got repaired. He could hit the edge of the road and fall over. This has happened, but luckily it was in front of the nursing home and someone saw him right away. He could get hit by a car. Already happened. He could get robbed or attacked or stung by a bee. All of these are real risks, but Marcel understands them, and so I say over and over that autonomy is part of being human. The nursing home staff and administrators grumble about liability, and I remind them about human rights. They give in, although we revisit it every time something happens, which, in the end, means he probably just doesn't tell anyone everything that happens when he's out by himself. We continue through the streets, up the hill, down the hill. I say, "That was weird." Marcel nods. And here's where I move into the second person. I realize only belatedly that you could have rolled over the hailing guy's foot, or that you could have driven away. A quick turn to the side would have put him off balance at the least, although he likely would have stumbled along beside you, his hands on your head. And if you'd evaded, it might have made him angry. I don't ask why you didn't try to get away, because I didn't try to get you away, and I'm the one with two working legs and working lungs, and I didn't do anything. The nursing home is long, low, and gray. It started out as one thing, and over the years has been added onto and onto so that it makes a jagged horseshoe. Having worked there, it's a familiar, comfortable place for me. Back inside, Marcel tells me it's happened before, the healing, the laying on of hands. With the same guy? I asked. No, he says, other people, other places, other times, I interpret. People just touch you? Yes, he says. I feel this viscerally, an itch in my skin, a heat. I shake my head, shake my hands. I've worked in customer service for most of my career, and people have occasionally touched me without my express consent. Usually hugs, usually prefaced by, can I hug you, followed immediately by the lunge forward. But I can back away or push them away. I don't, but I can. I'm sorry, I say. I should have told him to go away. Marcel shakes his head and I feel a little better until I realize he's probably only saying it to make me feel better. I'm sorry, I say. I'm sorry I didn't tell the healing guy to back off. I'm sorry I didn't scream. I'm sorry I was afraid I couldn't protect Marcel if we made him mad and he had a weapon, or no weapon except his hands and feet and teeth. I'm sorry I didn't tell him Marcel has a right to be asked before being touched. I'm sorry I can't be with Marcel all the time. I'm sorry he has a disability that makes it impossible for him to walk or talk or feed himself, and that many people see him as less than human because of it. I'm sorry they don't take the time to get to know him better. I'm sorry Marcel has carved patience like a shield. These things happen, he says. This is just the way it is. Not fair, I say. He rolls his eyes. Fairness is often the least of his concerns. Nearly 25 years after the healer incident, I get a phone call on a sunny Thursday afternoon. It's from a number I don't recognize, but I'm in the habit of answering numbers I don't recognize because Marcel has been in the hospital more times than I can count, and sometimes those numbers come up as spam. A woman says, I'm with Marcel, pause, and I need to know if he's all right. I immediately don't like her or this conversation. Her tone is too sweet, too syrupy. I don't know, I say. You're with him. Is she trying to tell me he's not all right? There's no urgency in her voice, almost a giddiness, a giggly nervousness. She says, I can't tell. Now I'm both annoyed and worried. If something really is wrong, she's doing a terrible job of communicating it. I ask where they are, and she names a street near his house. He often goes out for a stroll, so that makes sense. Is he tipped over, passed out, bleeding, vomiting? No, she says, drawing out the O. I get it. Suddenly, and with blinding clarity, I clear my throat. You think he's not okay because he's disabled. Well, she huffs, I wouldn't be able to sleep tonight if I didn't stop. I say. Now I'm really annoyed. Did you ask him if he was okay? Yes, she says. And did he say he was okay? It's hard to understand him. This makes me even angrier, because not only can Marcel nod his head just fine, he was able to pull up my phone number in his communication device for her, which means he probably also used his communication device to tell her he was okay. I say, I think you're confusing disability with illness. She repeats what I've said to her boyfriend, who huffs a laugh, then cheerily tells Marcel it was nice to meet him before hanging up on me. The next time I see Marcel, I ask what happened when this lady called me. He gave me a funny look. I say, you weren't expecting me to get mad, were you? He said no, she was just trying to be nice. He's right, but only partly. Once, a neighbor brought him back to the group home and told the house staff he shouldn't be out by himself. Nothing had happened. The neighbor just worried something would happen because of Marcel's disability. Once a neighbor, maybe the same one, called the police when Marcel was out rolling around the neighborhood. The police came and determined Marcel was physically disabled, but not mentally, unable to decide whether or not to be outside. I tell him what the woman caller had done was ableist, to see a person in a wheelchair and assume they need help, which actually I would have been fine with if she'd stopped there. But the fact that she asked him and then didn't believe his answer is misguided at best, insensitive, and prejudicial. I couldn't just thank her and let her believe she was some kind of good Samaritan. That kind of behavior, able-bodied people making a big deal over the disabled, is exactly what makes some disabled people feel like they don't have the right to be out in the world. Marcel nodded in agreement. Still, he said, at least she was trying to be nice. Later, I tell Steve that it's easy to be mad at people who are overtly anti-disabled, people who call him retarded or outright yell at him to get out of the way. But people acting under the umbrella of niceness feel more dangerous to me, more insidious. I believe she was truly trying to do a good thing. But does it matter what her intentions were? Diminishing a person's autonomy in the name of double-checking that they're okay is not okay.
Wow. I feel like saying, now tell us how you really feel, Jen.
I know, right? People keep saying like, oh, you were so brave to write all that. And I say, I'm not good at faking it. Like, I'm just not. Never ask me what I think of anything.
Wow. Okay. That like cuts to the heart of everything. That's why I call my podcast Daring to Tell. Because we write these things, and I love that you do state this so boldly. And I was thinking about communication through this because I just loved that there were so many examples of nonverbal communication through this whole, all of the encounters, but specifically the main one with this healer person. And the boldness that you have in, oh my God, that thing that I will say I relate to so viscerally, which is the like thinking of exactly what you would say after the fact.
Right.
It's like, now you're gone. You can exhale. And now you know exactly what you would have said. And the other one, I was like, just to say thank you to him and then go, what am I saying? Like, what?
Right.
But I want to extend my generosity to you because you were just trying to get out of a really bizarre and potentially scary, dangerous situation.
Yeah. And like, had I known that that was apparently it's a thing, and now that I started talking about it and asked other disabled people, this is a thing.
Wow.
Like people just come up to them and regularly try to heal them. I keep teasing all of my disabled friends that we need like t-shirts that say they've already tried or something, you know. And wow. You know, I do believe it's well intentioned, but I also am a person who just does not like to be touched without warning. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, meh.
No. Yeah. Right.
I don't know why people think they have that permission, especially when someone looks different than what we expect.
Right.
And think the rules are somehow different or something.
It's like this conversation that was going around. I hope it's still happening, but where a lot of Black women were saying, like, don't touch my hair. Like, you, like, what is with, like, what is up with that? And I thought, you need to tell people not to touch your hair.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, who is doing that? Don't touch people's hair.
Yeah. Yeah. And because I'm a like, oh, see the best in everyone sort of person, I also say, you know, well, they didn't mean to. Which is why I really appreciate you addressing the good intention part of this too.
And I actually hesitated to put that last part in this piece because Marcel really feels like I was wrong. So we disagree on this. And I feel pretty strongly. I think I could have been nicer to her. She really wrong-footed me right away, but I also think I am right that you know, she asked him if he was okay. He said he was, but she didn't feel like that was enough. She felt like she had to double check. that he was really okay.
And can I ask, it sounds like there was something in her voice.
I know.
That was the thing.
She was so giddy. And like, in fairness, I can be really giddy when I'm nervous too. So I feel like she probably was just nervous.
Yeah.
So I was probably more unkind than I needed to be, but I also didn't want to just let it go.
Yeah. I love this chapter so much. There are so many multi-sided, complex things that we get to climb inside of the way that you were moving through all these things and the cumulative effect of what that has for you throughout your friendship with Marcel, because the more time you spend with him, the more of these varied experiences you have, and the more you find out that this is pretty common for him. And so that's another funny thing to hear, like, wow, oh, so this isn't even strange for you, because I love the eye communication that you were talking about. When he gives you a look, and when that guy is there, and the look he gave you was like, okay, yeah, this is weird, but it wasn't a fear.
Right.
So all of those, I don't know, I'm just clued into this, how so much gets communicated that is not spoken words between us, and how that's the stuff of who we are and how we react to people, like, in very viscerally positive and viscerally negative ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the best thing about knowing people for a long time, though, right? Like, my husband and I have been together 25 years now, and there's so much, like, you know, like, you don't need to say a lot of, and it's so nice. Like, there's...
Exactly.
Sure, like, falling in love is lovely and everything, but I wouldn't want that forever. Like, it's the comfort of having somebody who's known you for 25 years, or hopefully much, much longer, that you just share a look and they know, they're picking up what you're laying down.
Exactly.
And it's nice with long friendships too. I
think exactly. Thinking about this woman, going back to the the woman who you ended with, who was well-intentioned, it made me look up the word ignorant.
Oh, yeah.
And so I looked up the root, and the root G-N-O is knowledge. Like, I mean, there's that Greek root, like gnosis, I guess. But there's another one that's Latin, that's knowledge. And the suffix R-O for ignorant is negating it. And so it means disregard.
Interesting.
Which I was thinking about. Disregard suggests that we know something, but we are not absorbing it. Like, we're not going to pay attention to it. It's a little like a blind spot, maybe.
That's really interesting, because I always thought of the word as ignorant as like not having the knowledge.
Right.
But you're...
I never like, thought of it that way.
Your definition is that some part of us has the knowledge, but is choosing to... Like, you know, when you walk down a dark alley, even though you're I definitely should not do this.
Yeah.
But it's a shortcut and I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Like, ignoring your better instincts. Mm-hmm,
better instincts. Yeah. Or I was thinking again about the idea of a blind spot, which suggests like we should know better. But again, how can we be aware of a blind spot? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyways, that was another word I was thinking of in the realm of the people that Marcel has experienced and that you've experienced with him. I was wondering also about this thing about friendship. And I was wondering if there has been a way that your friendship with Marcel has impacted your other friendships. Like, how does that ripple out? Or has it?
I've been told, and I hope it's true, that I am the friend that always shows up, that is always checking in on people, is always, and, you know, like, I try to remember if somebody has something coming up that's going to be challenging or difficult, or check in with them. And I've been told by my friends that I'm the person who does that. And I hope I am. I hope it's made me more just tuned in to people. I think a lot of people aren't, myself included, people don't ask for help. They don't ask, you know, will you check in with me and see if I'm okay?
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I do that so often with Marcel, and like leave space for people to actually tell you how they're doing.
That's interesting. That's a really good point. Do you feel like that's gives you permission to ask for help when you need it?
No, definitely not. I opened the book with talking about how I had my first panic attack and then lied to everyone to like not tell them I had a panic attack and pretend like everything was fine.
Yeah.
So I want to believe I've come a little bit mm-hmm. past that, but it's so hard.
Yeah. And in the, you were suggesting earlier too, or talking about how in the proposal for the book or your discussions with the publisher that they, Island Port Press, mm-hmm. also here in Maine, that they wanted you to include, like when you proposed it, you were wanting to write about Marcel, but they said, oh, it needs to be about you too. So how did that go?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard. It was, you know, like I said, I write fiction, and well, I think fiction writers will say, and I will say, that there's a lot of me in my fiction. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's true. You know, that's definitely true, but not like this. Like, this is like far more vulnerable. I really didn't want to put any of me in this book, but mm-hmm. I absolutely think they're right, because had I not, it would have been reportage, right? Like it would be like a newspaper story, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with newspaper stories, but no. It's not what this book is meant to be. And because it's particularly about friendship, I mean, who's he friends with?
Exactly. You happen to be half of it.
Right.
And we do get to see a lot of you. So through your friendship with Marcel, obviously we get to know you. And as in the example of the chapter we just heard, we get to see so much of your internal dialogue. So I'm wondering if that's at all related, or if you would like to tell me how you arrived at the title, Slow Motion. So how did that get to be a title?
So my working title forever was the title of the chapter I read, which was These Things Happen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and the folks at Island Port never said, we don't like that. They just said, how about these titles? So it was Slow Motion. The second one they gave us was Marcel and Me, which sounded like Marley and Me. And so none of us really liked that.
Yeah.
I think there was a third one too. And I ran all three of them by Marcel, and we both just really liked this one.
Yeah.
I think what you were getting at is I do have, there's a lot going on in my head, and the panic attacks forced me to slow down. Like they've forced me to take a breath and deal with those racing thoughts. But Marcel also makes me slow down.
Right.
The nature of our friendship, the nature of how quickly he can move through life.
Yeah.
Makes me slow down. And it's a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think before I even read this book and you shared it with me, I said, oh my God, I think about slow all the time, because I feel like I love things that are slow. And I think it's important to slow down. And when I read a book, the more I like it, the slower I read it. It makes doing a podcast like this really hard, because I can't get through any of the books. But I mean, I say that in jest, but kind of true, that when there's something that's more impactful, it's good to slow down and think about it more.
I say that about books I love, because I don't want them to end. So just start going super slow, because like you can see how many pages you have left and you're like, no,
exactly. Exactly. Well, the other question is the brave question, and you kind of like burst out with it at the end of the chapter, but what was the most daring thing for you about this book?
I definitely didn't want to talk about my depression and my panic attacks. I've always been, you know, embarrassed and sort of ashamed that I've had depression. But once I started talking about it, I've had this change of like, if I can stand in front of people and say that I have been through this, and then maybe somebody else won't feel so alone and won't be afraid to get help. I just want people to know it's okay to be in therapy. It's okay to get on medication. It's okay to tell somebody that you need help. And I hope that if I can stand in front of people and say that, and it's so funny because like I have advocated for 30 years that Marcel is a person into himself, even though he has disability, but I could not see my depression in the same way. Like I felt like my depression made me a lesser person, even though I never saw his physical disability as making him a lesser person, which is, I don't want to say crazy because I don't like when people use the word crazy, but it's like, it feels like a complete miss on my part, right? Like it took me this long to say,
right.
It's kind of the same thing. Like I'm saying he's perfect the way he is. Why aren't I?
Yeah.
You know, like it's okay to feel these things.
It is. And I have to say, I feel you 100% on that one. I mean, I really also feel like I have like maybe not consummate compassion and forgiveness and extension of generosity. I mean, I like to think I am that way. But with myself, it's the absolute hardest. And that's, I do think it was a very brave book for you to share all the ways that were your inner dialogue of what was so hard to go through. And that in spite of racing thoughts that I was like running along beside you with on those. It's Marcel who is the example, you know, like he is extending the kindness to you.
Yeah. Yes. And And sort of be, you know, I started this book saying like what I would say to my therapist was like, I can't die. Like even when I was deeply, darkly suicidal, I can't die. Marcel needs me. And I finished this book feeling like, I think I need him, you know, I mean, that is, you know, my therapist says like with depression, you just need a flickering light somewhere. Like it's, you just need to keep looking at that flickering light and it'll be okay. I think for a long time, that's like what kept me alive, really. But now I can say, I think we need each other. You know, I think it's really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm really grateful, you know, that I wrote the book to come to that. I I've been feeling really good. I feel much better but I think it's all part of this, you know, it's all part of that.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Actually. And what you just said, because in the book, Marcel's brother.
Yes.
Kills himself.
Yes.
And so that death from depression, which is, I think, kind of how you said Marcel said it, right?
Yeah.
He died from depression, which is such a wise thing to say.
Yeah.
Wow. That's
right.
That speaks volumes.
And it also, I know more people now who have lost someone to suicide. And I think we're, as a society, coming to a place where we can say, where we can see suicide not as a selfish thing, but as a desperate thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had somebody once say, cancer is an illness and sometimes people die from cancer. Depression is an illness and sometimes people die from depression.
Yeah. Yeah. And that asking for help for ourselves can be the hardest thing.
Right. But we would never hesitate. We would never hesitate to ask for help if you had cancer.
Right.
You wouldn't be like, well, I'm embarrassed to go to the doctor because I have cancer. Or my therapist used to say, if you broke your arm, you wouldn't be like, no, I'm going to just heal this on my own. You'd go to the doctor. But for whatever reason, it's like emotional, mental state. We feel like we can't.
Yeah.
We can't.
Yeah.
But that's not.
Yeah.
And that I was super high function. Like, people didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't know.
How am I not surprised about that? I mean, I think many people, we're like, I'm going to hold it all together and I'm going to figure it out. I mean, it is just a gripping scene when you're in the car and calling Steve to say, I don't know if he was your husband or not at that point, but like, I'm going to be late, but I'm not going to call him till I'm partway home. And then, you know, like the image we're projecting that I have to keep it all together.
Right.
But, you know, in a funny way, that's something that helps you keep it together with Marcel when you have these weird things like someone coming up and saying, I'm going to heal you. It's all just so bizarre.
I know. Yeah. And I think it's a good trait to be able to like keep it together. But I also think there needs to be some balance there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. A little middle ground.
Yeah.
Well, that's to go back just to the title, too. I'm actually delighted to see that that was one of your options. This happened? Is that these things
happen?
These
things happen, yeah.
Because I love that rhetorical part in the middle there where you're saying this could happen, that could happen. These already happened. And there are so many more in the book that have happened that I just shake my head.
And Marcel, truly, I guess having such a significant disability makes you sort of have to roll with it because I was astonished that people just come up to you and try to heal you. But Marcel was sort of like, it's not that big a deal. So I think there's a lot, even being friends with him for 30 years, I think there's a lot I don't know what he goes through.
And isn't that also true about any friend?
About anybody.
I mean, it's a very generous thing for both of you to have shared this story of this friendship because we can see ourselves in many ways in both of those. And that's to go back to the fiction versus the memoir. Like, that's what I think is so touching and inspiring about memoir is to see and put yourself in the shoes of another. I do think it's a really difficult and brave thing that you did with the permission of Marcel to tell someone else's story. And I just love that he was like, yeah, tell my story.
Yeah. And when you asked, like, what's the bravest part of this book, I think it was exceptionally brave of him. And there were two things that he didn't know about before this book went to publication, and I told him because I couldn't be out in the world without me not telling him.
And he
wasn't surprised by either of them, and B was totally fine. I mean, he gave me, you know, permission to say all the things that, you know, we talk about his bowels, we talk about, and he really, I mean, that's really brave. So
as someone who's had rectal resection surgery, that was the part where I also said, wow, I have a lot of empathy for what he has been through those story, that part of it too.
Yeah. I mean, to be that sick, it's so unpleasant.
It's awful. Yeah. Awful. The poor guy. I mean, I really go, geez, Louise. Is there anything else you want to say about this book or about your writing or getting to this point? Yeah.
I think one of the most surprising, and I guess it's surprising to me because I have not written nonfiction before, is how many people share their stories in response to this book. And I think that's lovely. I think that's really special. And I feel really lucky to be given, like, that people feel like they can hand me their stories is really lovely. I've heard that, you know, I've heard that from people who are memoirists, but I wasn't really expecting it.
So it's a little surprise.
It's That's nice.
Wonderful. I hope Marcel gets that too, you know. I hope he will.
His care manager reached out to us after she read the book, and I read the email to him, and it really resonated with her, and it was lovely.
Well, I think I'll leave it with that. Such a wonderful book. Thank you so much, Jen Dupree. It was great to have you here today. Really good conversation.
Thank you, Michelle. This is wonderful.
You know, another thing I didn't exactly say about this book, it's a real page turner. I was holding myself back going, okay, can't wait till I sit down and read the next chapter or next section of Jen's book. It is a gift from Jen and Marcel to every reader it reaches. There is a link in the show notes for Jen's website where you can check out her other two novels as well and see a picture from her book launch event at Longfellow's in Portland, which Marcel attended and was apparently a very special evening. There is also an events page at Jen Dupree's website, which lists all the places she will be visiting through the spring and summer, mostly throughout Maine, doing book talks, and a stop in New Hampshire as well, where writer Melanie Brooks will be hosting the event, who, as Jen mentioned, has been on this podcast before and whose audiobook, A Hard Silence, was the very first one to be recorded right here at what I call Flying Pig Audio in my very own closet studio here on the midcoast of Maine. And in fact, I have a growing catalog of audiobook titles I am extremely proud to have produced with their author narrators. If you go to michellerado.com, you can hear some samples and sign up for my monthly newsletter called The Redo. I really hope you have enjoyed this conversation with Jen as much as I have. I always think about how, well, if you've made it this far into the podcast, you probably have enjoyed it. So this is where I do list my thank yous. I think first I'd like to say a big thank you to Marcel for your desire to share yourself with us through this book, along with your friendship with Jen. And Jen, thank you for taking that intrepid dive into a whole new genre of nonfiction. A big thank you to my singer-songwriter husband, Phil Rado, for the gift of his music on this podcast. I often fish around in his catalog of songs to see if there's one that matches up with the theme of the episode, and I think the tone of this one is pretty close, because isn't it a lucky thing to find friends that last over time and having the chance to let them know about it? My biggest thanks as always to you for daring to listen. I will catch you next time.
I can still remember telephones as I'm heading home. Do my best thinking while I'm all alone, and I'm heading home. I've stopped worrying about stones I've thrown, all those milestones, my lodestones. I can still remember telephones, and I'm heading home. It's a lucky spot we're in. I feel a confidence within. What a joy it's been, what a joy. We're in a lucky spot. And I remember all those stepping stones when what we wanted most was ours alone. I put my shoulder to the grindstone, and now I'm heading home. Songs from Sun, all those hired guns and Roy Orbison. I remember almost everyone, one by one. It's a lucky spot we're in. I feel a confidence within. And what a joy it's been, what a joy. We're in a lucky spot. It's a lucky spot we're in. I confidence within. And what a joy it's been, what a joy. We're in a lucky spot.